Thank you very much. To a wonderful chair of a wonderful conference, so thank you. So we're going to jump right in. We don't have a lot of time, and in the spirit of great work with Opportunity Youth, as they've been renamed, or Disconnected Youth, we're going to start with a participatory option. This is the secret way to get you off of your iPhones and Blackberries. So we want to know who you are, and my esteemed fellow panelists might have a question for you. But let's just start by asking you to raise both hands if you're from a family foundation. Raise the roof, all right? And if you're from a community foundation, that wasn't both hands up in the front. Interesting, some pretty good representation. You're from a different kind of organization. Sometimes we refer to you as an infiltrator. Chris Gates, the ultimate infiltrator, yes. How about if you've heard this this term opportunity youth before this panel? Disconnected youth, Ann says. Anybody heard that expression term before? Yeah. So not most of you. How about this, I shouldn't call it a buzz because maybe you won't raise your hand and it won't be, but collective impact, this theme of collective impact. And how many of you actually read the most forwarded article in the history of the Stanford Social Innovation Review on collective impact? Raise your hands. Close to at least a third of the room. How many of you forwarded it to someone? Yeah, those are the real zealots. Great. Just a couple other questions. How about coming from a foundation or an institution with a staff of 10 or more? I see. How about 5 to 10 staff in your shop? Interesting. 3 to 5. Raise your hand. 3 to 5 staff. Small but mighty. How about 1 to 3 staff? Great. Before I do the obvious next question, having just come from working at the Gates Foundation, how about a family foundation with 1,100 or more staff? Small family foundation. How about one staff? How many of you come from a shop with one staff? Oh, we feel your pain. Very busy. No staff, volunteer family foundations, great, AKA check writers, I think is what some of us in the field call you. No staff, all right. It's really actually helpful. I'll ask my colleagues, do you guys want to ask any other questions of the audience so we know how to tailor our talk? Or let's jump in. Okay, so here's the frame. Those of us who have been in the youth space, and in particular in the disconnected youth work, feel like this is a moment in time for really meeting the needs and creating greater opportunity and greater access to opportunity for disconnected youth, or what the recent White House Council renamed Opportunity Youth. And they renamed them Opportunity Youth for a few different reasons. One is that they did a return on investment study as part of the White House Council's recent work. And they found that reconnecting this population to opportunity has the most dramatic impact on local economies as any other strategy in terms of addressing poverty. Second is they identified that the opportunity youth, the cost of opportunity youth to taxpayers, just in last year, 2011 alone, was $93 billion. The annual taxpayer burden is $13,900 per year, and the social burden is $37,450 a year. So a disconnected young person is very expensive. Same time, they did a bunch of really interesting polling with this population as part of this recent White House Council for Community Solutions, and they found out that young people who are out of school and out of work between 16 and 24, which is how they define opportunity youth, are incredibly optimistic. They are incredibly hopeful. And they believe that with the right supports and the right chance, and many of them never got a first chance, and I would submit that most folks deserve a second chance, but with the right opportunity, they could achieve success, and they were still believing that they would achieve success, despite all the data we know about the limited mobility now in our country for low-income folks, which is a big hot topic, not only in philanthropy, but in government. So this kind of research and this focus of a White House counsel, along with a set of other products that came out of that work, really actually triggered a ton of momentum. You had national groups like Opportunity Nation zero in on this population. You've got now a real movement now to revive career and technical education in our country. And there's just a lot of hope in the field for the folks who do the heroic work on a day-to-day basis. And we're gonna hear from some of them shortly. I'll shut up. There's some hope now for greater impact for the opportunity youth population. There's also, for folks on the ground, this is the first time there's been this top-down, an actual White House effort around this population. And the work that I do at Aspen now is launched out of the work of the White House Council. So it was the White House Council for Community Solutions. Now the Aspen Institute has the new Aspen Forum for Community Solutions. And the biggest piece of work for the Aspen work is this Opportunity Youth Incentive Fund. Because the other thing that folks are really thinking about in the field is this collective impact frame. And there is no greater population for trying to achieve collective impact with than the out-of-school, out-of-work population, because let's face it, K-12 has a role, higher ed has a role, foster care transition systems have a role, juvenile justice, the courts, et cetera. So in order to get to better opportunity, those systems need to get in the same boat and row in the same direction and track the same data and pursue positive outcomes. So this is the merger of those two, and that's also part of the momentum at Aspen. It's the work we're doing to partner with a whole host of national funders, from Bloomberg Philanthropies to the Zaitz Foundation. I was trying to do A through Z, and I got B through. And so there's just this real moment in time, and that's what we're going to talk about right now. So let me just turn to our first panelist with two questions, and I didn't set her up brilliantly for this, so I apologize, Anne.
Oh, great, okay.
So Anne Stanton has done just heroic work for many years, both as a practitioner in the field around this work and also thinking about the bigger systems. How do you really make K-12 relevant so that we have fewer opportunity youth out of the K-12 system? And she's also had to tackle the issue of systems change in the state of California, which I know is going super well, I assume we're gonna hear. And the Irvine Foundation has been an investor in some of the products I discussed, these different research tools and papers that came out of the recent White House Council's work. And her boss served on the White House Council. So we've got the trifecta of opportunity in terms of what Anne can talk about. And she's got now 5 to 8 minutes to share her story with you. So without further ado, we're going to start. I joke that we're going to start with the least important folks on the panel and work our way to the most important. That would be the moderator and the funder, least important. Exactly. Youth leader, most important. So we'll hear from Anna Ice last. But go ahead, Anne.
So, this is a topic that is incredibly dear to my heart, and it's so exciting, I think, at a national level, and certainly, even in this room, to understand that perhaps the perfect storm has come. And we understand that if we want to achieve what we want for this nation, both in terms of its capacity to thrive, we have to stop ignoring the fact that we are failing so large a segment of our youth population. So as Steve said, I came to the foundation 10 years ago very much from what I would say, I guess nobody will quote me on this, from the other side of the world, which was actually in communities, building programs, housing, employment, education programs, both in New York City and in San Francisco for homeless and runaway youth, perhaps the most disenfranchised, most at-risk population of this subset of this population that we're talking about. So I believe enormously and passionately that on a moral level, we have to get this right, and it's time we focus on it. So I think it was amazingly exciting when the White House Council which was obviously intended and, you know, established by executive order by President Obama, to really look at how do we have community-led solutions to the nation's, you know, largest problems. And I think for us, and with my boss, Jim Canales, who was on the White House Council, began to look at what were some of those issues that you could really use a bully pulpit and really begin to look at how can we look systemically at an intractable or what seems intractable problem, particularly the number of, you know, young people that are really not able to find their way back to opportunity, and that we needed to figure out how communities and cross-sector partnerships could really begin to think about that and how we could begin to change what it is that we are doing and the ways that we're working together across systems, not just in the spirit of collaboration, which is incredibly important. The spirit of collective collaboration is really important, but how do you then take that one step further, which is to make that accountable to the young people whose lives that we're changing, are hoping to change. So I think that's really important. Key factors in that are really, I think, a collective spirit to reduce isolation, right? I think it's very, very hard for young people who are undereducated and underemployed to find a way back. So we have to continue to really support programs and approaches that are working to really connect young people back to economic independence or the pathways back. I think we have to really focus on training and supports, that we have to create visible, viable, vibrant pathways that combine education and the economy and give young people a way to get to family-sustaining wage that ties to their aspirations and their dreams, which is really critically important. And I think we have to count in large part on their skills and leadership, because they have so much to contribute to what this nation is about and what this nation can do if given the opportunity to really be full participants in that. So at our foundation, how it impacts our work, you know, as we look at the focus of the youth program, and our youth program is focused on really increasing the number of low-income youth in California who graduate high school on time and receive a post-secondary credential. So we have put a ton of supports and dollars into what we call link learning, which is an approach for really marrying deliberately academic rigor that needs to be in high school with equally relevant real-world experience that together is stronger than either can be separately. So we're really encouraged by the fact that at a secondary level, this is really taking, I think, anchored in California. We now have a statewide pilot of link learning. So it's all really exciting. That's the part of the pipeline that's equally important. We got to keep the kids on the pipeline, connected to the end of the pipeline, to the goalpost of high school graduation and to post-secondary attainment. But we couldn't reach our goal, we realized, if we were just focusing on the 1.5, 1.6 million kids who were in high school or in post-secondary. Because there was another 1.6 million kids that were undereducated and are underemployed in California and disconnected. So how do we achieve our goal for the state without paying attention equally to both populations? So we're really excited to have the opportunity to be supporting work in communities in California, to be part of Aspen Opportunity Youth Fund, and to continually learn. You know, if this was an easy problem to solve, if this nation could do this easily, without coming up with innovation and collective ways to really take this on actively and deliberately because it's the right thing to do, we would have mastered it a long time ago. These are really difficult and important conversations to be having, collaborations to be having, cross-sector partnerships to experiment. I don't believe we have all the solutions. I think we need to experiment. I think we have to figure out how together we can figure out what's working, bring that to scale, and then also look at what we don't know and what we can try together. So that's what we're doing.
That is great, although we may not have all these solutions, but in the spirit of good, healthy debate, I think Anne might have most of them. So we're gonna hear her opening commentary. And I'll just say that Anne Higdon has done heroic, if not legendary, work in Dayton, Ohio, a place that has dealt with real economic challenges over the years with this particular population. And so I'd rather than steal her thunder, I'd rather have her share her story around actually while we don't know all the solutions, we're starting to see real models, real pathways emerge to opportunity for this out-of-school and out-of-work population. And Exhibit A is ISIS in Dayton, Ohio, and Ann Higdon's work.
Well, thank you. And you said all the good things I told you to say. I appreciate that. let me give a minute, just take a minute to tell you where I'm coming from. I was first homeless when I was four. And I was listening to somebody introduce me. I was selected as one of the top 10 women in Dayton. And I stood there listening to all the good things. They were good things, I know, because I gave them the information. And I remembered that my father, when I was 12 years old, looked me in the eye and said, "You'll never amount to nothing." They were giving me the award because I created the project that replaced food stamps with the card that everybody now uses. And I had created an organization with my own resources, ISIS, because it, which means Improved Solutions for Urban Systems, is an acronym. I went around saying to people, we need to do something about the 62% of the kids that are dropping out of school. We need to do something about the fact that the next system they hit is the justice system. And according to reports I read, when they're incarcerated as a juvenile, 7 out of 10 recommitted within 3 years. And people pointed out, they said, "Are you an educator?" And no, I wasn't. They said, "Have you ever ran a not-for-profit?" And no, I hadn't. So I used my own resources. Now, the word for teacher in Japanese is sensei, and it means one who's gone before. And if that counts for anything, then maybe I did have something to contribute. Fast forward, this started in 1990, incidentally. We incorporated in 91. In 2011, of the 58 public schools in the city of Dayton, our three schools, which incidentally one reporter said, the youth are the overaged, underachieving, non-attending, court-involved, disciplinary problem, dropout youth, our three schools placed number 1, 2, and 3 highest performing of every public charter school in the city of Dayton, with 7 out of 10 in the justice system and 80% of them returning dropouts. Wow. So one of the students said, "So what do they think of us now?" So the experience that I'm sharing with you is how we got there. First 8 years, we worked with the educational system, but they weren't waiting for me to come along to change what they did. I talked with students, they said, "I don't know why I need to learn that." They said, "I'll never use it." They said, "Nobody there likes me. I messed up, and now every time something happens, they think I did it. They said, "They don't know me there." They said, "School is boring." They had all the reasons. It doesn't have to be the right reason, but from their perspective, it's why they dropped out of school. So we created an educational environment where they had the academic performance, and we used competency-based. Because when students drop out and they decide to come back, they may be 19, maybe they dropped out in the 12th grade, but they're reading at the 7th grade level. So we would use a nationally normed assessment, get an idea of where they functioned, and then plot their growth trajectory versus putting them in a particular grade. Then we made it hands-on. So if you were learning computer tech, you refurbished computers that we gave to poor kids that lived in the inner city. If you were in construction, you built homes that we sold to families earning 80% or less of median. And if you were in advanced manufacturing, then you operated a plant that had the capacity of building all the walls for 7,000 square foot homes in one shift, all computer managed, because that's the manufacturing of the future. If you're in healthcare, then you spend part of your time in hospitals and nursing homes. It's not like Dr. McDreamy when you go into healthcare. And most of these young people only know what they saw on television. So it was a rude awakening for them to see that mostly it was old people there like me needing a lot of care. So it was very much hands-on. Well, the advantage to that was they understood how to use the principles. You can't learn to swim standing on the side of the pool. So you can't learn these, whether or not you're suitable for these various careers that you may or may not be interested in, with somebody talking to you the way you're listening to me. So it became very hands-on. As far as our instructors are concerned, we didn't follow any of the rules. We hired from business and industry, The Department of Education said that they had to be certified, so then we enroll them to be certified in the college, which took usually 2 years, but they were certified provisionally from the beginning. Because we needed a post-secondary piece, we got our instructors, if they were teaching, for example, construction, we were using the industry's curriculum so that they would be industry certified, and the training that they got with us counted towards their first year in that career. If they were going on to college, they would take their courses from faculty that we got approved as adjunct faculty at the community college, so we could teach the first level coursework. It wasn't so much a model as some ideas are. What we did was every year we'd look at what we did. If it worked, we congratulated ourselves. If it didn't, we didn't do that anymore. And the next year we came up with our next best idea. So it evolved to be a school with 7 out of 10 youth in the justice system, overaged, underachieving, non-attending, court-involved, disciplinary problem, dropout youth, that placed number 1, 2, and 3 of all the public schools.
It's beautiful. And, you know, there's a connection, a linked learning, if you will, between some of the themes we heard. One is that competency-based is a really important part of the solution. But I think what I would just point out from what Ann Higdon just shared, building on what Ann Stanton just shared, is that the way the systems behave now, it is like pulling nails to create this kind of alignment, to get the post-secondary connected to the dropout recovery program, to actually leverage the private sector. Anne didn't share her whole story, but she has these pathways for young people who were dropped out, who are now getting the pre-apprenticeship credential for carpentry, for electrical, and for plumbing, while rebuilding Dayton, while building actually LEED certified homes around the blighted neighborhoods of Dayton. So you talk about collective impact, and you talk about the kind of leverage that you get when systems align and sectors, both the private sector and the systems that are meant to support young people, and you start to get to positive results. But we're now trying to figure out in the coming years, how do you align this kind of entrepreneurial hook or crook, don't tell me no because I won't take it for an answer kind of work at the site level with the now the opportunity that comes from what's happening in the federal government. So for example, there's an interagency task force on disconnected youth working across all of the major, you know, from Department of Labor to Department of Ed to Health and Human Services, trying to figure out how the heck we can replicate the Ann Higdons of the world and that work on the ground, and how can those separate funding streams, which actually come with a disincentive to partner with each other across federal departments, how do you create actually waivers and all kinds of resource availability that's based on outcomes? It's based on 70% of these former dropout court-involved kids achieving a family-sustaining wage at the end of the day. So there's a lot of momentum in government to actually incent what Ann, and I'll turn to you in 1 second, I promise, Anaïs, but what Ann first said to me when I first met her is, we just violate these systems. When they don't work for our kids, we violate them. And my response was, just turn violate into innovate and we will keep you out of jail. But the point is, no one should have to go to jail or have to violate a system to actually serve young people, to help young people get to the next level. So that's point one. And point two is, both Ann's touched on it, the power of young people being actors in their own change is super important. CJ Callen knows this better than anyone. So how youth actually take ownership of the solutions that are being set up for them, and how does youth voice get elevated in this work? The great news is the White House Council for Community Solutions spent a lot of time talking to young people. And one byproduct of that is this new National Council of Young Leaders. And I'm not gonna steal Anaïs thunder, but she's gonna talk a little bit about her own path, her own work with young people, her own experience as a very young woman. I can say that as a very old guy. And we'll get let's cut through all this gobbledygook language of collective impact and opportunity youth and talk about what's real for youth. So I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you as well and the Aspen Institute for the invite. It's a tremendous opportunity to be here, and thank you guys for your time and attention. My name is Anais Santangiorgi. I currently attend Northeastern Illinois University, majoring in social work and interning at United Way, ironically. So I am here because I am a multitude of all these risk factors that impact opportunity youth, or youth that are neglected and they don't have these resources. Briefly, my history, like I mentioned, my risk factors are tremendous. My parents, when I was born, were drug addicted. I was raised by my paternal aunt. Throughout the years, I had issues with connection. I had issues with developing positive relationships and just believing in myself and taking these opportunities as they were handed to me. So by the time I got to high school age, I was literally a rebel with no cause. I was hanging out with the wrong people. I was doing poorly in school. And I didn't want to hear from anybody, even though I had a family who cared for me and wanted to give me the best. They weren't my biological parents, so there still was that issue inside me that I had to address. So when I got to high school, I did not have the resources to do well. I didn't know exactly how to navigate the system, and it was a Chicago public school. If any of you guys are familiar with schools in Chicago, they're not the best. They don't provide a system for young people to thrive. If you don't make it within their idea of what a successful young person is, then you fall into the cracks very easily. And Chicago has a lot of distractions. If you don't want to go to school, there's 50 other things that you can do and have more fun doing. I always make a joke about the systems. I was in my junior year, I dropped out of high school because I didn't have enough college credit or enough high school credits to graduate with my class, even if I did night school and summer school. The first day of my junior year, I did not go to my eighth period class. And a couple weeks later, I didn't go to my seventh period class. The school did not find out about this until March. So I had missed easily about 100 days of school, and they didn't find out about it until March. My consequences were to do an in-school suspension, which you sit in a blank room with nothing, and they give you books, and you sit at a table, and you're expected to do assignments. Assignments that had nothing to do with what the rest of my grades were doing, but it was busy work. It was either that or they had to deal with you. And so that's just one aspect of how things can fall into the cracks. So the way I chose to get involved and take charge of my own life was rebelling. I hung out with the wrong people. My aunt couldn't tell me anything about what time to come home, what to do. And so I took charge of myself in that aspect, not knowing that there were other opportunities out there for me. My freshman year of high school, I was engaged by a youth service agency, Build Incorporated, in Chicago, and Build gave me an opportunity to engage in pro-social activities. I was a part of a youth council. We planned events for, our peers. We fundraised, and we were representatives of the organization. Build also provided me with lifelong mentorship relationships, mentors that even to this day I still look to for guidance, whether it's personally, professionally, and academically. Even though I had an outlet, I was able to go to this youth service agency, I still decided that I didn't want to do right 100%. So, like I mentioned, my junior year, I dropped out of high school. I attended a challenge program in downstate Illinois and graduated with my GED.
Was that the National Guard Challenge program?
Yes, Lincoln's Challenge Academy in downstate Rental. Mm-hmm. And so the environment was extremely intense, it was very militant, and you had no choice but to take part in your own, passively because you were being told what to do, but they provided people to get you to critically think about your own life and how you can improve your own circumstances, even if nobody else would do it for you, whether it was family, friends, or, and a lot of these other risk factors, abuse and neglect. And so once I graduated from the challenge program with my GED, I obtained a position at Build Incorporated, a part-time position, and that for me was monumental. I went from being a youth served to having to serve youth and young people. And it wasn't until then, I was 18 at the time, that I realized how my life had been impacted, what Build was to me. And even though I went on my own path, that they were still there to encourage me and get me into the right direction. So I was there part-time, and from there I was recommended to Public Ally Chicago. My mentor, who was probably the only person I was really close with at the time, he was an alumni, and he knew I was having some financial difficulties, and he was an alumni, so he knew that I would benefit from it. I applied in August of 2007, and their application deadline was March. But because I had been referred from an alumni and highly recommended, their recruitment specialist decided that, you know what, she can benefit from this, and they've seen all my initiatives trying to move myself forward, so they accepted me into the program.
So let's pause on that for a second. How many of you have heard of Public Allies as we go back to the, raise your hands high so we can get a sense. Okay, good.
Public Allies is a great organization. They do leadership development training, and they target young people, this opportunity youth, so that way they can critically think about their own lives and assess and analyze their communities and backgrounds and how they can engage themselves into a better outcome for the rest of the community. And so through the program, it's a year long. They place you within an organization for 4 days out of the week, and on one Fridays you do an 8-hour training on communities, community development, how nonprofits function, and the role in the entire system. And so once I left Public Allies, I was able to identify myself as a professional in the field. I knew that I wanted to work with young people. I knew that this was a passion of mine. And I also knew, had I not had opportunities like Public Allies and Build Incorporated, I would never have made it out of my situation. I can easily count 10 people from my high school class who are no longer with us today because of gun violence. These are their alternatives. They didn't have these opportunities, as we mentioned earlier. So fast forward a couple years later, my mentor at Public Allies, who's now the interim director, she sent me this email saying, the White House Council on Community Solutions put together this panel, so to speak, where they want to have young people talking about the issues that affect them and what happens next. So I was nominated, I was accepted, and I am now a representative of the National Council of Young Leaders. Our initial get-together, we met up in Boston. There was 14 of us originally, representatives of 7 national youth-serving organizations. We met in Boston, and we basically locked ourselves in the room for the day and talked about all of our lives and what commonalities were there. The result of that is the recommendations to increase opportunity and decrease poverty in the U.S. We made a policy recommendation with 6 immediate recommendations that across the board we had all, without these things, would not have made it. Things like access to higher education, mentorship relationships, comprehensive programs. And through that, we presented at the Opportunity Nation Summit in D.C. We've been on a whirlwind since then. Some of the things that we've done since then, we've met with a handful of government agencies talking about opportunity youth and how they specifically can support opportunity youth and the council in general. We met with the White House Representative of Public Engagement and Youth Outreach Department, which was tremendous. President Obama, he put this together, and he's really putting a lot of effort and energy into this and addressing these things. And our next phase is just advocating for the expansion of opportunities for programs and youth nationally. We really want to get this movement and get as many people involved, not only because of the benefits, financial benefits, economically, for engaging these young people, but also that these are lives that people are impacting. I think a lot of times funders don't necessarily get that. Yes, your dollar goes to, you know, 15 youths showing up to a program and getting off the streets for 3 hours. But specifically in my case, it was a lifelong journey that without those investments when I was 14, I may not have been here today. You know, I'm a couple months graduating with my bachelor's. I'm able to, you know, present here today. I'm able to have these mentorship relationships with young people who were in my situation. And so, on top of all the things that we do nationally, I still am very much involved in direct service and just having that one-on-one impact. So that's fantastic. Everything in a nutshell.
Yeah, if we were having a meal, I would just say, check, please. I think that is a great representation. I have a couple of quick reactions, and then we only had, you know, an hour, so we only have a little more time. We want to open it up for Q&A, but do any of our panelists want to riff on each other or comment? Anne.
No, I just think that, you know, first of all, thank you, because I think such a rich voice. And I do think that, you know, it's so important that we always keep in mind, and you're going to smack me for saying this, but I think, you know, as we're thinking about collective impact, as we're thinking about the big systemic change, and we know that that has to happen if we're really going to truly be able to respond at the scale we need to for the young people. At the same time, there are a lot of family foundations in this room that might not have the resources or the desire to do big systemic change. And I think what you've heard here is also a ringing endorsement for the programs on the ground that are making sure that these young people are alive day to day, frankly, that have food and shelter and opportunities and can see a pathway back is so critically important, because without the community-based organizations that are in many and often the liaison point between those young people and the next step in their lives, we cannot achieve that impact. So I just want to call out that's a really important role that is part of that systemic change. Sure. It's an incredible role that these organizations play.
I can't believe you said that.
I know, I know.
Because that's what I was going to say. What I wanted to just call out from that story, and thank you for sharing your own story, is that, you know, we do know about some of the solutions out there. So while I said we don't have a second chance system in our country, we have these pockets of innovation with potential for scale and potential for impact at scale. And if we can align existing revenue streams and repurpose some of the funding streams that already exist out there, we can actually make this the rule instead of the exception to the rule. But the experiences are deeply rooted in great community-based organizations. They're also rooted in national initiatives that do operate at a scale, that have gone through third-party evaluations, that do have great evidence of success. National Guard Challenge Program is one of those. You know, there are 20-some-odd National Guard Challenge Programs around the country where young people who are about to drop out or recently dropped out go to a campus, a National Guard, you know, location, and go through a rigorous boot camp-like experience. It ain't a lot of fun. Necessarily, but the structure of that combined with really intensive, rigorous academic catch-up strategies leads to incredible results in terms of getting back on track. And there are other, and Public Allies is a national initiative funded by AmeriCorps, which is the best kept secret in this dropout recovery space, because we know when a young person who has been told from an early age that they ain't gonna amount to anything, as Anne was told when she was young, actually experiences the transformation of giving to others, that's the epiphany. That's the transformational moment that then inspires getting ahead, staying on a path, and ultimately graduating from college so that you're a contributing leader in the community versus the number I gave you of $529,000 of lifetime drain on our economy. So there are systems and programs and there are pathways, and we have the potential to get them to scale, and now is the moment for that. And at the end of the day, none of those pathways are nearly as significant as they ought to be. And so if you just invest in a program that does amazing work, that isn't a just thing, that is a big thing. So I totally agree. Anne, did you want to add anything?
Yes, I wanted to give some examples. I gave a 30,000-foot view of what we did, but how we did it, I didn't say. When I said that we hired from business and industry and then had them go through the training to be certified so they could teach at a high school level, you could, with your degree, go and teach in a college, but in our state, you couldn't teach at a high school level, right? But the resources that it took for us to do that came through foundations. When we wanted to connect our construction program to our advanced manufacturing program so that we would rebuild entire neighborhoods versus a house or a couple of houses, it was a foundation that enabled us to do that. When we wanted to figure out how to make changes in what we were doing so that we could be more effective and do the research for that, it was a foundation. When we wanted to look at how well we'd done, in terms of everybody wants to know, have you done any studies, longitudinal studies? Or who pays for that? It was a foundation. When we had a different idea, when you're using government funds, for example, a 920-hour school year for kids that are years behind, I mean, you work, your work week is 2,080 hours. So when we wanted to expand those hours, it was a foundation that allowed us to do that. So all of the places that allowed us to innovate and that allowed us to improve our performance was because of the private gifts that we got. And the people who would listen to a story, ask the hard questions, if you made sense, they said, okay, we'll give you a chance. And then I just want to say, the very first, when this was an idea, and I forgot about this when I said I was the first funder, the second funder, I took the idea to a foundation, and they said, well, wait a minute, that's not a project. I mean, she's not even, you know, she has no experience in whatever. And the woman who was the administrator said, let me let you meet with three members of the foundation, have breakfast with them. Why don't you explain what you're trying to do? Why don't you answer their questions and see how that comes out? It was a small foundation in our area called the Ittings Foundation. They provided funding not only then, but at other critical times in our growth that we could not get anywhere else. Would have been impossible.
That's a great example. And I think that's part of the message that we share today, which is that the connective tissue, the coordinating dollars to do collective impact, if you're going to get judges to actually cut a kid's probation in half when they get a GED, or if you're going to get foster care transition dollars to actually fund housing close to the local community college, or if you're going to get post-secondary education institutions to create dual enrollment strategies that allows Pell resources to flow to the wraparound supports that have to be there along with the academics. If you're going to blur the lines between systems, the philanthropic investment that covers the costs around coordinating and connecting and leading, that's a place for funders, and I think that's part of our message. We should just open it up. I have a few more questions, but I don't want to leave us short. So if you do have a question for the panel, for the room, please just stand and come to the mic right here in front. And if you want to queue up at the mic, we'd love that. I used to, you know, hope for queues at the mic. It doesn't happen very often. But please identify yourself, and then please do ask the question.
Hi, I'm Deborah Simmons. I'm here from Colorado, the Boulder area, and I recently moved from Columbus, Ohio, where I worked in a correctional facility with a lot of 20-somethings who were in for drug-related felonies. I've also worked to start a shelter for girls who've been sexually trafficked, and I've been trying to figure out, how do I work as an advocate to change the system so kids don't end up in jail for drugs and stuff like that? And now that I'm hearing your program, I'm thinking a better use of my limited time and resources would be to alter the course before they get there rather than changing the system at the, you know, judicial level to make it, to get there sooner, like happened for you. And I'm wondering if you know if any of these programs that you guys have been talking about are in Colorado.
I will mention, so one thing that I've heard a lot recently, especially with this discussion on system change and direct service, is it comes down to prevention or intervention. Where do people want to invest in? And I think a lot of times prevention is a great investment, but in your instance, you want to also work to decrease those risk factors of them returning to a certain lifestyle. And so it has to be a double-edged sword in a lot of ways, where prevention is more long-term. And if there's a bunch of money invested in prevention, that's great, but then there's this large gap of people who will never receive that. And so it has to be this model where they're both addressed, which can be really difficult. And the same thing, you know, that we've heard, it's everything is connected. And so in order to address one thing on the systems, we have to address the things that are happening on the ground level. But how do you do that when one, people are stubborn and don't want to hear these conversations? And the other thing is that everything is so much, these risk factors that young people are facing, they're not just one risk factor, they're not just two, they're multiple. And the young people themselves don't even know that. And so it's having these dialogues and figuring it out from there and having the people who need to be at the table there. And I believe there is a Public Allies in Boulder. And so that's something that I can get information for you on. Thanks.
You wanna?
Yeah, I think Those are really important points. I mean, I spend my because we're investing, you know, so much in high school and transforming those. I hear, too late. Why are you bothering? I'm going to go back down to. And I also, of all the things that I get like worked up about, I think that question drives me, you know, crazy. Because the reality is, for most young people, we have gotten, you know, what, in California, 1.6 million young people who are undereducated, underemployed. We have failed them. The system has failed them. We have a moral obligation to make that right. And so I think, yes, we need to do both things. We need to ensure that young people are continuing on that pipeline and they're not hemorrhaging them out of the system so they become part of what we need to do for recovery for those young people. So I think we have, you know, we have to work across this continuum, ensure that as many young people that stay connected can stay connected, and that we are making up for some serious time connecting young people who have graduated without the skills, have high school diplomas, don't have high school diplomas, are undereducated, are underemployed, and find the way back. It is what is right for this country to do. So.
Yeah, bravo. I'll just say we can talk afterwards because there's a great youth build program, yeah. Mile High Youth Corps in Denver. There's the spot. There's a lot of great stuff. And the school system is going through some really innovative change, to Ann's other point. So it's not an either
both
or,
and.
It's a both and. Hi.
Hi. Jonathan Lazarus, the Satterberg Foundation in Seattle, Washington. Two short questions. Ann, I've heard that you said charter school. So does that mean that part of the solution is to break away from the existing education system to get what you need? The second question is, I've heard a lot about folks who, when you ask a child or a youth, what would you like to do with your life? They say, I don't know. What are you interested in? I don't know. Do you think that interest aptitude tests are an important part of the solution to help people understand where they might do well in the world?
Wow, those are profound questions. As far as charter schools, they're state laws, you know, and so they're very different from state to state. In our state, for example, you receive only the state allocation, which is less than half of what that young person would get if they were in the conventional system that failed them in the first place, or that they failed in the first place. So it's not enough money, for one thing. If the money followed the kid, and you got all that child was allotted, whatever school could provide that service would then be funded. To me, that makes sense somehow. It's difficult to do because of the governing agencies that that have the authority. So some charter schools are good, some are not. For us, what we did was we created competition. So the Dayton schools ended up creating a couple of years ago a school that, if you read the description, it sounded so much like ISIS. Because once you took this on, and of course it took 20 years, but once you took it on and the State Department of Education said that you had outperformed all the other schools, you have no metal detectors, right? You've got all the ones that they don't want. It sort of takes away the excuses. It becomes harder for you to say, well, it's the families, it's this, it's the kids, it's the whatever, because we had all of that. So investing in good charter schools, they have to have a longer day and more hours if they're going to take the dropouts and do dropout recovery. That's absolutely necessary. It should be related to real world, competency based, career technical piece, not because you're deciding that they're going to go into business and industry, but because they have no frame of reference. When I grew up, I didn't know anybody who owned a store, who was a dentist, who was any of that. My father was a chauffeur. My mother was a maid. All of our relatives were service people. So there was no frame of reference for anything else for me to aspire to be. Do you see? So the hands-on experience where it proves to them, boy, I can do this, I can be in healthcare, I can be a nurse, I'm certified as a patient care technician already with phlebotomy and EKG and whatever. It builds a whole new possibility for these young people. And it isn't that we don't know it, but systems are very hard to change. Systems fight back. So I've stood on the other side. What if I became a teacher, understanding that I would work in the classroom for 920 hours, and I could spend the summers with my family and the whatever? Would I want that to change suddenly? But for those people who come along and say, let's make a different plan, you have to allow that to happen and allow that to occur as the systems change. And then I guess the last thing is, with the government money that comes in, if you apply for a grant, you get it for 1 year. How long do you have that kid? Do you know? So, and then the next year you have to compete, and maybe for no fault of yours, it goes somewhere else because they want to share it. You know, they want to make sure they've got all of the, they have it politically positioned. Mm-hmm. And so you still have the kid and you don't have the resources. And then the last thing I want to admit to is this. In all that we did at ISIS, we became legends in our own mind. We were so proud of ourselves, I tell you. We closed our doors last year because the business plan created income from the students. In 2008, just imagine this, our students are building 14 houses a year. We buy the land, rebuilding entire communities, our manufacturing kids are. On the government side, we accepted the resources saying we would sell to families who earn 80% or less of median. What happened in 2008? Couldn't get a mortgage, right? But we, if we don't finish it, we owe government back all of its grants, which come to us as a loan and converts to a grant once we complete and sell to a family who earns 80% or less of median, right? On the other end, we did construction loans just as any company would do. So we have the loans and we're paying interest. But everything has come to a screeching halt. So a business plan that was absolutely brilliant 10 years ago becomes severely stressed, and the highest performing schools with 23 years of investment goes out of business, and there's nothing we can do, right?
Well, we can go to funders meetings and talk about it. You gotta try. What I would say about that is, you know, if ever there were an economic development strategy that deserved a bailout, I would say it was ISIS in Dayton, Ohio. We are really close to time. I know you have the final question, and then I'm going to give our panelists an opportunity for one final word of advice to a bunch of people with money and power and who can change the world, and that's you all.
Anais, I'm wondering whether there's any discussion among the National Council of Young Leaders about maybe replicating state councils, or, for instance, in California, where we're struggling with realignment, local councils, so that policies affecting youth can be informed by youth. It seems to me with maybe a lot of the family foundations here wouldn't necessarily take a bite of a national apple, but a state. Mm-hmm. Council, a local council, it just does that seem?
I think the one thing, when we met originally in Boston, we didn't know where this would take us or what necessarily direction we knew. We knew that we wanted to impact change and be a change engine to a sense. And so one of the things that we've kind of branched off to is realizing that yes, we need to have these conversations and dialogue with people at a national level and with our government agencies, but it really just comes down to getting the right people in those positions locally and our aldermen, Senate, and into Congress, and so that way they can take this on as well. So part of our initiatives now are engaging people at a local level. There needs to be representation on these councils. There needs to be someone to say, hey, this is my life you guys are talking about. Can I sit here too? And so that's the direction that we're moving in now. And we're really just trying to make sure we do a thorough amount of research to see how that looks and where these people can be placed. And in that sense, we're engaging a whole other level of people so that they can take on this as well. So yes, it needs to happen all the way around.
So just to add, you know, one of the great national organizations that did this report and has supported the National Council of Young Leaders and trained them extraordinarily well is CJ Callan's organization. CJ, you want to just raise your hand. So, you know, based here in Northern California, the Youth Leadership Institute is one of the very best at elevating the voice of young people. So if you have more questions about youth voice in California, she is the first person I would call. So that's it for the Q&A. I want to give everyone one sentence. it can have some colons and stuff in it, but one sentence of advice for our wonderfully engaged audience going forward as we think about collective impact for Opportunity Youth, our systems change, focused on better outcomes for our nation's young people who never had a first chance. What's your one sentence?
Well, maybe it's a disclaimer. The impassioned plea was not so much for ISIS, but for the cause, because that's what I believe in. And so now I'm believing in Steve Patrick and his initiative, and then we'll take what we've learned. There's an organization that says, I don't make anything, I make things better. Maybe that's the role for ISIS going forward.
One of my favorite quotes that's actually in the book is, all that we are is a product of we have thought. And so I feel that it's definitely powerful in having these big ideas. And for myself, I've always had these big ideas. And it's, you know, through the people who've supported me that I'm able to get these into play. And it's really just making the most of your time and energy and sitting down and having conversations with people and seeing where there's need and how you can be supportive.
Yeah.
I would just say, you know, in a very hopeful spirit, the time is now. It's not too late. Get involved.
And I get the last word, so I get the most colons in my sentence. I think there are three things I would leave you with. One is that constituent voice, no matter what issue you're working on, is critical, and Exhibit A is here with us. So always making sure that we're getting feedback from the very folks that we are meaning to serve in our grant making. Two is pursue the public-private philanthropic partnerships, because even if you only have a little bit of money, you got a lot of leverage in your community, and you can get systems to behave better, frankly, more easily than Anne was able to, even though she did an amazing job, because you can actually pay for the connective tissue work and the coordinating work across those systems. And third, and you heard it from Anne with her one-year funding story, you can't solve life cycle problems on a grant cycle timeline. So when you go deep, go long, and keep investing, and don't be impatient, but walk with your grant makers, your grantees, as you try to leverage systems change while, you know, providing opportunity. Thank you very much. Let's give our panelists a round of applause.